Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 706, March 2024.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. This is our final episode, unless we do an episode about Back to the Future the musical sometime. Probably not.
The animated series, the ride.
But part three is a movie that we haven't covered yet because we did part one and part two. Now here we are at part three. We've gone further back in time, or forward in time, 6 months to the release of it in May 1990. Yes, it's the one where they go to the Old West. And joining me to talk about it are my panelists. They're wonderful. Here they are. It's Lex Friedman. Welcome back, Lex.
It's great to be back to the future, Jason.
I'm glad that I'm sad that you missed our part two episode. You don't get to talk.
Me too, because it's my favorite one of the whole series.
Too bad. John Siracusa, hello.
I'm ready to talk about the final chapter in the Manure trilogy.
Oh, man. More manure will there be manure? It's on the checklist, right? Of is this a Back to the Future?
Oh, it's
movie?
Like you got the Cornetto trilogy, yeah. From Edgar Wright. This is the manure trilogy.
Manure, yeah, sure. Brian Warren is here. Hi, Brian.
What kind of stupid name is that? Wait, is that didn't work out well for me?
Monty Ashley, hello.
Hear me out. Back to the Future 3D.
Oh, interesting. I hope there's a shark that jumps out. Wait, that's the other movie. And Moises Chuyon, hello.
Hi. I don't have a witty thing, planned or unplanned.
That's okay.
I'm just gonna follow my train of thought.
Great Scott! Just say that. It'll all work out. Back to the Future Part 3. Rather than just kind of going back through the contents of other movies, is a mostly standalone story about Marty going back to the 1880s, to the Old West, for a Western-themed adventure where he has to go find Doc, who in the last movie was trapped in the past, and he has to change time because the Doc is supposed to die a week after he sent the letter, and so Marty is going to go back to the past, save Doc, and then finally, hopefully, go back to the future.
They do have overlap in this one. Overlap is very big with the kids these days. I see a lot of television programs that people watch. Mm-hmm. You'll watch one episode, and then the next episode will start, and the last 5 minutes of the previous episode will be there, or the last 2 minutes, the last previously. 60 seconds. And this, not previously on, just literal, here's a minute of the end of the last episode. This movie does that.
Yes.
The really beginning of this movie is the end of the second movie.
And in many ways, the end of the first movie.
Yeah, well, obviously, right, mm-hmm. But this is the footage from the end of the second movie with the other Marty coming, and they just replay it. They don't do previously on, they don't do scenes, they don't do a summary, they just play the scene, which is, they were ahead of their time, because, like I said, that has become a very popular thing in television these days.
I love that scene.
That's how previously on is now done.
Yeah, I love that scene, because that's the scene from the first movie where Doc is victorious in getting Marty back to the future, and of course, it's such a wonderful button on the second movie that Marty appears immediately and says, "No, Doc, I have a new thing for you to do." And he just passes out. It's still funny. So that's how this movie gets started, with scenes from previous movies, because it is Back to the Future. I realized in watching this that this is the one of these movies I've seen the least. And I never remember how Marty gets back in time.
Yeah, I have the same thing until they mentioned the mine, and then it came back to me.
Right. But
have that problem.
There's just so much that happens in the 50s where they fix the DeLorean. So Doc from the past, from the first movie, now gets to witness the Mr. Fusion version of the DeLorean, which is kind of funny. So he gets more spoiled about what's going to happen in the future. But remember, he still also has the letter about his own fate, presumably, that he's going to don't think about it too much, but that's all going on there. But the idea is they're going to fix the DeLorean, but Marty finds a picture of a tombstone from the past with Doc's name on it that he was shot by Mad Dog Tannen, Biff's ancestor, a week after writing the letter. And so Marty disregards Doc's, you know, letter that says, don't come back for me, I'm doing fine here, and has to go back. That's the thing that incites him traveling back in time. And they're able to work it out where they are, because it's Mr. Fusion now. They can fix the DeLorean and enough for him to take it back in time further. And so actually I left out the part. The mine is the best part, and that's the part I always forget. See, I forgot it again, which is, well, how are they going to do that? And the answer is Doc has walled off, and this is a very Doctor Who kind of thing, has walled off the DeLorean in a side chamber of an old mine that will still exist 70 years hence. So they're able to go to the mine and extract the DeLorean in the 50s because it's been sitting there for 70 years. They just let time take it forward in time, which is very clever.
Right by a cemetery, which I think is a bad idea for like digging purposes.
Convenient, though.
Subsidence. Yeah.
People die in mine accidents. The cemetery is right there.
The tires have disintegrated off, but everything else, totally fine.
Totally fine. 70 years later. Well, I don't know. Maybe it got like some future coating or something.
It's like the gasoline in The Last of Us. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. But I love that bit because that's just such a great time travel bit of like, oh no, I just left it. And then you go, I'll tell you where it is. You go get it. Okay. All right. So that's pretty great. So I like this section fine. I think it's fun to see 50s Doc again and spend a little more time with him. Because we haven't spent time with him since the first movie.
I loved it. I loved having this movie started so cozy, like with them kind of warming up by the fire and everybody's just kind of having a nice cozy moment in his living room, which we didn't spend much time in before. It just, after the darkness of, the alt history in Back to the Future 2, like this was really nice to see these two back together. I felt like we're in a safe place and we're starting from a good spot.
Yeah, the warm fuzziness of Doc waking up thinking that he hallucinated everything that we just saw happen for the last 3 minutes, and then be further shocked when it turns out that no, Marty really
great
is
physical
there.
Acting.
I love two things in that opening scene at Doc's house. Right, once we're there. Seared in my brain always when I think of Back to the Future 3 is the hoverboard from the future in Doc's house in the 1950s. Oh, yeah. God, I love that. And then you have that moment where he's terrified Doc falls on his
organ gag, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's so good. And it goes for so long.
Yeah. I just love Doc's 1955 house, which I have written down here as a mansion and a half.
Yeah.
And then Doc is moved by his own writing. God, I love it. Everything about that opening scene is perfect.
There's some plot in the first movie they talk about how he has to sell the mansion, essentially, the family mansion, in order to fund his activity.
Didn't it burn down or something?
Did it?
It did. There was a newspaper clipping. Yeah. I can't remember if it was from TV.
I think that was the thing with the oily rags on the model in the first one.
I think that's it. It depends on the timeline.
Yeah, getting some extra time in 1955 Doc is great. And like this movie, for me, is such a showcase of Christopher Lloyd's talent because we get to see him play disparate evolutions and de-evolutions of Doc Brown, where we've got the the very slapsticky, you know, almost vaudevillian comical youngest Doc Brown, and then we'll get to plenty of this later, but we get to really see the texture of him having grown and settled into the idea of being able to settle down and not just constantly being on this this infinite train toward just, you know, inventoring his whole life and finding a life to live beyond just these kind of archetypal things that are what the character's been for two movies.
Right.
And this is the beginning of that, and we so quickly, you know, get to current Doc relatively speaking, that there's a great opportunity there. That there is one other character that I want to bring up that isn't actually an actor or personage in the movie, but it's cinematographer Dean Cundey, who frames shots so beautifully. There's so many images in this movie in particular that are so vivid, because from the rain and the lovingly, you know, hovering over Marty and Doc passed out in his living room and seeing the different things in the house, the camera is its own character in this movie in the good way, in a way that doesn't stick out, but that gives us a very particular view on things. That's why these movies so vividly stick in people's memories. And even though we don't spend that long across all three movies in 1955 Doc's house, you get to know that space in a very short amount of time.
Speaking of non-human characters, though, Copernicus has some real talent in this movie.
So, and I love his headlamp.
He reads the grave, I guess. He can read?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we don't know what experiments have been done on Copernicus, and the movie doesn't tell us, but I appreciate
the fact...
He can
smell 70-year-old remains, smell.
I appreciate the fact that there is a... enough time, there's a brief amount of time separating the Einstein, I called my dog Einstein... moment, and the moment not too much longer where he calls out for his dog and says, "Come on, Copernicus," and it's just long enough that it made me laugh extra hard at the fact that he doesn't understand how he could possibly name his dog Einstein, but of course he names all of his dogs after scientists. But yes, he does, I guess, either yes, smells something of Doc's in the grave from 70 uh-huh. years before, I don't know, and presumably at that point in the timeline, you know, his dead body is down there. They could have exhumed Doc's dead body right then if they had wanted to.
Well, movie dogs always magically sense things that humans don't, and sure. It's not too much of a stretch to extend.
Well,
that
he also plays chess, so every part of it beggars belief.
Yes. Yeah, it's part of the dog union rider. You have to make sure that
he's
the dog,
super smart dog
evokes superpowers.
It turns out that Doc also made super smart dogs, but he decided that was also too dangerous. And didn't. Anyway, yes.
Well, speaking of getting the DeLorean, this is actually one of the more subtle and sophisticated gags that they don't press on too hard because it's not that funny. But like he's got the microchip and he's got to make the 1950s version of it. And I'm not sure if they got the scale exactly correct, but the idea that to make an integrated circuit with discrete components in the 1950s, it's that tiny chip that's the size of a postage stamp becomes a thing on the hood of the car.
Yeah,
they don't really press on that too much, and I bet it is not really registering with most people, but it's close to being, you know, correct, and is funny that
I love that gag.
It's like the people, you know, the magic, what's the big deal with computer chips? It's like, well, they could do that stuff before, but it was huge, and so now you can make it a reasonable size. But he's got to use 50s components, so there you have it.
Yeah, and he can do it. Doc has worked that out, right? But it's this giant.
It's just a bunch of transistors, but the transistors used to be way bigger back then.
Just huge. Yeah, it's good stuff.
What exactly is the point of Doc firing the gun to trigger Marty's drive?
He just likes to fire guns.
Okay,
just, he shot it a couple extra times just for fun.
Yeah, just celebrating. Yeah,
didn't he do it in the first movie to when it's timed? Oh no, it was an alarm clock. Never mind.
Why do Buford's team fire their guns in the air while they're chasing Marty?
Well, that's a different thing. They're not Doc.
It's old.
They're
West,
bad guys.
It's old Westy. It's already getting us into the old West spirit. Okay, Marty goes back in time to 1885.
There's a very on the nose gag when he does it, but we'll accept it.
The Native Americans are surprisingly unconcerned.
There are a lot of on the nose gags.
This is the third movie in here, and so they've already sort of repeated and retwisted a lot of the lines, but they've got a third shot at it now, and I give them props for finding a third way. So what he says to Marty is, "Where you're going, there are no roads."
I know, so
okay.
Good.
Oh, right, I'll give you that one, right? And, you know, the obvious gag with the Native Americans and their stereotypical glory is there, but we accept it and it's fine.
Well, here's my theory about the whole movie. The reason he's in a drive-in movie theater, which my first thought is, that's not a lot of runway to get up to 88 miles
nope,
an hour.
Nope. I thought the same thing.
It's because he's driving into a movie.
Yeah, it's true. He's driving into a Western.
There's the Indians, there's the cowboys, or the cavalry. He goes into the saloon, there's the three guys that are in every Western movie.
It's the closest to a 1950s 3D effect that you can evoke in a movie shot in 2D.
Is Monument Valley really close to Hill Valley?
No, it's not. No. Well, so this is one of the things I was going to say, is that they shot, yeah, Hill Valley's in California, but like for some of, a few of the Western scenes they shot in, I guess it's actually Northern Arizona, but yeah, it's basically Utah style stuff. And it's totally different terrain. And it makes me laugh because, as I said in the last episode, most, except for those Monument Valley-esque kind of backdrops that we see here at the drive-in movie, and then when he flashes through the print of the Indians running toward the camera to the actual Indians running toward the DeLorean, that stuff is in Arizona. The rest of the Western stuff was shot in Tuolumne County, California, where I grew up. And I know exactly where they shot it. They built that set on the railroad tracks of the Sierra Railroad. I've been on that train. it's pretty funny to see that. And the hills and the trees and everything. I'm like, oh yeah. I'm from there. I see those hills. I'm like, yeah, it's like I'm home. It's hilarious. But I just want to say, no spectacular desert mesas nearby. Just as a, they want to make it extra Old Westy, and I totally get it. But I don't think Hill Valley is in Monument Valley.
I truly believe it's a conscious attempt to evoke 1950s Old West movies.
100%. Yeah, that's what it is. Because this is an homage to Westerns is what's going on here. Now, I know that everybody gets their own opinions about the Back to the Future series, and some people like the first one the best, and some people like the second one the best,
woohoo!
And some people like the third one the best. But what I will say is, I like the first one the best, but I find this movie delightful. I don't really love the second movie, as we said last week. You can boo me if you want, Lex. But this movie, what I like about this movie is, yes, it's silly, it's fun, it's playing with all the things that have been in the first two movies, and I don't think it's as good as the first movie, but what I like about it is the whole premise of the movie is really, hey, we got a time machine, let's do a Western one. And I mean, it's really, that's all it is what if it was in the Old West and they had an adventure there? I'm like, okay, let's do it. It really feels much more like the second movie feels like, let's play around with the premise based on where we left the first movie, and then ultimately play around with the first movie. This doesn't feel like either of those movies. This feels like, let's do an episode of the adventures of Marty and Doc, and this is the Western episode.
And honestly, that's my single biggest issue with it, is because I'm not a big fan of Westerns in general, because I always feel gross when I watch Westerns. Like, I think about how dirty they all are and how gross the sand would be and how it's everywhere.
I don't think they actually had buckshot in their food, though. I think they know how to clean that out.
I don't universally love Westerns. I grew up, you know, brought up, trying to be told that I would be interested in Westerns. I was not really interested in Westerns, mm-hmm. but as Westerns go, this is actually a really good Western. For me, the meta Western nature of it makes it so that I'm not having to watch John Wayne drone on about, how genocide's a great idea. And
they're playing with the tropes, right? Like, what they're really doing is they get to dress up in Western clothes. Although Marty's pink, 50s cowboy outfit, hilarious. They get to dress up in Western clothes and play with the tropes. And if there was a Back to the Future 4 that was in a different genre or era or whatever, I imagine it would have been exactly the same thing, which is, let's dress up in the clothes and play with the tropes and then move on. Whatever it was. It was a horror movie. It was, you know, like a universal monster movie kind of thing.
You go to a sci-fi setting, you know, Star Trek.
Right?
This is basically a Doctor Who approach to time travel, where you just go to a place, have an adventure, and eventually you go home.
Yeah, and although this does want to have character development. So, it takes the stupid character trait from the second movie and does something with it for Marty. And then it gives Doc a character arc that he didn't really have in the other movies.
Yes.
And, you know, so.
Yeah, I agree.
In that way, it is very much like an episode of a middle of the road Star Trek type series, where it's like they're going to have an adventure. There's going to be some learning and growing. Yeah. Fundamentally, things won't change that much. We could have another episode after that and it would be fine. But anyway, this is the Old West one.
Yeah,
there are a lot of really passionate takes on all the Back to the Future movies. But one of the ones that, I mean, I disagree the most with is that this isn't a Western. It's a sci-fi story that happens to be in a Western setting. But you got trains, you got a horseback chase, you got a love story, you got a shootout. You've got, I mean, it, yes, it is very meta. Yeah, it is very referential. But
It is fundamentally a Western narrative, which is, you know, why Lex dislikes it. And I respect that opinion, even though I may disagree with it. You know, at least Lex has my side on this, the right side of history, that is.
Oh, good. That's a relief.
You know, Doc and Marty, they spent most of part two apart. And so I'm really happy to see them back together. And I think that part three represents that return to form. Like, I like Western movies. I also really like Back to the Future movies. So having them together while also building on those tropes of, like, Marty's a fish out of water, just like he was in 1955. Doc and Marty are buddies. They're going to team up and solve the problem of getting back to the right time and fixing the trouble they stir up along the way. Like, that all feels right to me.
Let's take a break, and let me tell you about a sponsor that's not from the Old West and doesn't involve time travel. Or does it? No, it doesn't. It's porkbun.com. And you're asking yourself, like, a bun? A pork? What is going on here? Actually, Porkbun was named the number one domain name registrar by USA Today. They offer hundreds of domain extensions at low prices, powerful web hosting options, and personalized support 365 days a year. Bring your own bun, I guess. They've got a domain extension that's perfect for anything you're into. They've got .coms. We all love the .com. I got a bunch of .coms, but they've also got, you know, your .quest, your .gg, your .blog, your .games, and many others. They've got all of them. Plus, every domain name from Porkbun comes with a ton of freebies like SSL certificates, Whois privacy, URL forwarding, web and email hosting trials, and so much more, because the good people at Porkbun do not believe you should have to pay extra for things that should be free when you get a domain. Right now, listeners of The Incomparable can get $1 off their next domain name from porkbun.com by clicking the link in the show notes, or just go to porkbun.com and use code TheIncomparable24 at checkout. Grab the domain name you want and start sharing what you're passionate about. Porkbun.com, code TheIncomparable24, or just click the link in the show notes in your podcast player of choice. Thank you, porkbun.com, for supporting The Incomparable. Okay, so he makes it there, after seeing the Indians and the cavalry,
they don't see him, right? Like, everyone just ignores this weird
metal
box.
Well, he does get an arrow in the car. And by the way, good job jacking up the suspension on the DeLorean, whatever, like, off-road modifications they did for that. The ground clearance is, like, five times what it was in the first movie.
Yeah, great point.
So because where they're going, they don't have roads. At least he doesn't drive the car into town, right? But it looks like he could, but he doesn't.
Well, knowing that he's driving it over rough terrain, they had to have jacked that up, because otherwise the production would have had trouble just moving the car around.
No, it would have kept bottoming out. It's like a monster truck in a couple of scenes. Yeah. You can look at how high the suspension is.
Bouncing.
In the future, Doc had the suspension mount. Anyway, he hits his head and awakens, again referencing the first movie. His mother's waking him up, but of course now it's his great great grandmother
who looks like his mother for no earthly reason.
For no earthly reason, because she's from the wrong side of the family. But it's Back to the Future, and his great great grandfather, of course, played once again by Michael J. Fox. They are the hilarious Irish immigrants, Seamus and Maggie McFly.
The accents are bad.
Bad.
Mm-hmm. Real bad.
Yes.
Mr. Eastwood.
Almost far and away bad. Like Nicole Kidman, Tom Cruise pretending to be Irish bad. But I mean, I don't want to breeze all the way past, you know, finally Marty got to marry his mom. Because watching it this time in the glory of 4K, I went, wait, did they bring Eric Stoltz back to play his great, great grandfather? Oh, no. That's just Michael J. Fox doing a really horrible accent. I guess his red hair is not just because he's Irish, but in tribute to the guy that they fired from the first movie.
Beautiful fine furniture.
Beautiful pine furniture.
Yeah, and there's a fake Crispin Glover at the end of the movie, too. in the background.
Yeah,
I do feel like this is insulting to people in the Old West, though. The idea that they wouldn't remove the buckshot from their rabbit that they eat and that their water would be dirty. It's like,
they can make their own movie.
Yeah, it's just like the bits, it's the jokes.
Wait, for
folks.
A gag of like, oh, people in the Old West were dumb and dirty.
I don't know. I there's a lot I like in that scene. Like, this movie, I think, is actually maybe the most tightly edited of the three, where there's just like a lot of very fun transitional shots and a lot of just fun that we skip more downtime in this movie. We cut from Doc talking about one thing to there he is. And in this, you know, they've got scenes that when you know what to look for, you can see how grandpa or how great-great-grandfather McFly is handing the baby to Marty. But like when they pass the plate, that's a great shot. I watched Marty McFly passing the plate or getting the plate from his great-great-great-grandfather over and over again, and I can't quite see how they did it. It's amazing. It's really, really good. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, those in-camera effects are beautiful. The optical effects are beautiful. This was very much the height of all that kind of stuff before everything shifted to doing things other ways. I mean, on that same point, Lex, the editing and the choosing, you know, where different scenes end and begin. We talk about Seamus bringing him into town. Do we have to watch him take Marty to town? No, because there is no furniture moving that they need to do so that scene needs to exist. We cut from thing to thing to thing, and movie's 2 hours long. Doesn't feel 2 hours long because there's a respect for our time.
So Marty finally makes it to Hill Valley. It is now they've got the little town that they built out in the countryside for this movie. There is actually very close to where I grew up. There's a state park that is a gold rush town. I'm sure that would have been, and I think maybe they even investigated shooting it there, but of course they would have to shut down a state park for weeks and that wasn't going to happen. So they built a similar looking town out in the countryside to use in this scene. So Marty arrives there and you can see they're building the clock tower. There's a railroad platform. And then there are some various buildings of some ramshackle ones and some newer ones that are like brick. And this is Hill Valley and he is looking around for Doc, but he can't use the name McFly, I guess, because there's already those McFlys. So instead again, harkening back to the first movie where he had an alias, he decides to call himself Clint Eastwood.
Shouldn't he get good at remembering that he's supposed to have an alias at some point?
I guess not.
Yeah, in the animated series,
he has to do it.
I think it's still a gag in the animated series that he keeps having to remember that when he goes to other times, he has to come up with an alias, and it's a whole cute thing. It's the thing that Marty never truly learns.
I guess the idea is that in the Old West times, no matter what the place is like in modern days, it was like this in the Old West. So if you went to like, you know, Tampa Bay, Florida, in the Old West times, it would look like this, but then it looks like Tampa Bay with palm trees. Like this becomes a tree-lined suburb. in the 50s apparently, but right now they're in the desert. They build that clock tower, it just, you know, it's sitting there in the desert. It's like, don't worry, this will all be trees and shrubs and suburbs in 70 years.
Because as we know, building out urban infrastructure tends to make things greener.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they take the water from somewhere else and they bring it in.
In another beautiful example of the really tight exposition handling in this movie, you get, you know, when Doc explains to Marty that they don't have easy access to gas, so they're going to have to find something else. They try the horses. They try alcohol. He thinks about going downhill. Then they think about the train. And the whole thing takes like 60 seconds of film time, and it's just great. I love that.
Why did they try the train, the horses, though? Like, he knows. He rattles off the fact about how, did anyone think horses could go 88? No one thought that. Doc knows that already.
No, but it would look cool, John. It would look cool.
They just
wanted
to have
so much more important.
Of the DeLorean being pulled by the horses, but it's kind of like when he runs to the grave where it's like, you can just have that discussion and say horses can't run 88 miles an hour. So we're not going to do that one.
Lex, I had the same thought and I went back and timed it. It's like less than 4 minutes that they spend from, oh my goodness, we're out of gas to here's, we have a plan. Let's start executing it. This is pretty nice for a 2 hour movie.
What if he just paid Buford off?
Right. Well, this is the moment. Like, I had that moment. So Buford Tannen, he runs afoul of Buford, you know, Mad Dog. He calls him Mad Dog. He's like, no, I hate when people call me that. And there's the whole thing that happens there. And Doc rescues him. And what we find out is that Doc and Buford have a dispute over money and like a thing that he fixed, and he, like, there was a horse and he let go of the horse because it threw a shoe, and he, like, now you owe me for the horse. He's like, well, no, I'll fix the shoe, but I'm not going to compensate you for the horse. And it's on the gravestone. It says shot in a very specific gravestone that I don't think you should dwell on the way that the person died on their gravestone. But maybe there was nobody there. Surely Clara could have spoken to it. But it says basically shot by Buford Dannon over
That's
$80.
Weird too,
so
they actually say who killed him on the tombstone.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there must be some sort of like fairness in Tombstone's act.
Yeah, well, the tombstone guy was like right next to where he presumably got killed. So, you know.
Yeah, he said, I got a story to tell. This is going to be my masterwork. I'm going to tell the whole story on this tombstone. So, I did have that moment. I guess the movie wants you to say that it's too late at that point. But I did have that moment where I thought, just give him money. just give him money. I know Buford probably doesn't want the money anymore. He wants to kill people. But like, could you pay
him
off?
Guys, the dog plays chess and it's a time travel movie. I don't think we have to get too hung up on whether that plot point is believable. I'm just saying.
No, I'm just...
Doc does say he wish he paid him off.
My thought is like, I just keep thinking... Could we try to pay him off now? And the movie doesn't want to do it, and it's fine. I don't think that's a plot hole. I just think it's frustrating. I think the answer is that Buford wouldn't listen anyway.
Well, I think the idea is that Doc, it's a principle, and Doc is, this is perfectly fitting with Doc's character, that he's like, no, I'm not going to pay you the money. Like, and that doesn't make sense, practically speaking, but Doc is not particularly practical, and he has his principles, and he's not going to pay for something that he doesn't think he deserves. And I guess maybe later learning that, oh, by the way, he's going to kill you according to this picture I have, might have changed his mind, but at that point, he doesn't know.
Yeah. I will say, he really isn't Biff. Like, Michael J. Fox does not disappear into his alternate characters. Tom Wilson. Is a really good character.
Yep.
Super great.
Tom Wilson
MVP. deserves so much credit, not just for the differentiation, but I mean that it's not that these are just distinct different people. It's that he's doing something different with it that I don't think was there necessarily as part of the remit from Zemeckis and Gale. He's finding stuff for himself in these, and I think he has historically not been given enough credit for not being one note, because people just think of some of the, you know, the most iconic bullying scenes from the first movie and try to paint his entire series of performances across the series as just being with that one brush. But I wish that history and fandom had been kinder to just how much really great work he put into this.
Because good for writing goons too. Like, he's always got goons behind him, but the goons aren't the same either. That would be the lazy way, like in every century, right, every time his three goons are the three same, goons. But his three goons are not the same.
There's one moment in the saloon that, much like the Marty using the hoverboard as an ottoman, that always sticks in my brain, and that's when the bartender pours the whiskey for Marty,
and it smokes, and he kind of
yes, it sizzles on the bar, and that's one of those moments that I always think about with this one.
It's weird that the bartender insists that they only serve whiskey, but then later on we learn that Doc normally drinks something much less strong than sarsaparilla.
Some brown water, probably.
Gross. It is funny to me to see the things that they think they should keep consistent in each movie. like it's almost like we don't know what people loved about the first one, so let's just do all of the things again. Like, we need a hip band to be in this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I give them credit for finding a third mix. Like, in this one, they're pretty understated. They have a scene, I forget which one it is, but at one point, both Doc and Marty are exasperated. And Marty says, "Great, Scott," and Doc says, "It's heavy," right?
Just a simple
reversal. Great, they don't dwell on it, but it's like, third movie in, sure, mix it up one more time.
Yep.
I mean, Doc has said "Great Scott" around Marty roughly 10 million times at this point. It would be shocking if Marty hadn't picked it up.
Right. But then Doc picking up heavy as well. Like, again, these are characters that have progressed a lot. And Doc has had, I mean, Doc has been in 1885 for a while now, right? That's part of it too, is that he's spent some time there.
He's established. He's a businessman. He's got all his inventions. He's got his gun with the scope on it. He's got his giant machine that makes a single cube of dirty
ice cube. Yeah, that's right. Ice cube. But he hasn't met Clara, which is funny because the tombstone implied that he had a long time love in the past, but he when Marty goes back there, he's like, I don't know anybody named Clara. But guess what? Doc's job is going to be to pick up the school teacher, Clara, at the train station, which he fails to do. thereby forcing him to save her, because she's then, like, I guess, decided to drive herself in a wagon of her books and stuff. and then the horses run away, and snake
scared the horse. Yeah,
there's a whole thing, and then the books go in the ravine, and so that's,
let's talk about Mary Steenburgen for a minute, because I love Mary. I think she's a great actress. I think she's even great in this, but I don't think she feels right. Meaning, I think she feels very modern. I feel like every other person in the 1855, every other person there
1885.
is trying to act like they're in 1885. And she feels very much like she was in the late 80s, early 90s. Like, she does
she's a typical character of movies of this time, where the school teacher is modern and forward thinking in a way that's well out of step with
the
society.
But I'm not even talking about
in.
her forward thinkingness. I'm talking about just her way of speaking. Like, she just speaks like today.
My headcanon is that she came from the big, big city of Indianapolis, and has her big city way of talking and her book learning. And she's not quite these hayseeds.
That's Larnin.
Larnin, sorry, I mispronounced it. Larnin.
I think she's been stereotyped as somebody who falls in love with time travelers.
Ah. Yeah, it keeps happening time after time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Lex. I enjoy her so much that I don't really care, and it's a silly movie with lots of cartoon scenes in it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's literally a scene where a character has a funnel put in their mouth as a concoction is poured in it to revive them.
Well, there's a guy talks like this.
Yeah, it's a cartoon. Even more than the second one is a cartoon.
She is a little out of place, but so is Doc, so they're kind of perfect for each other.
Yeah.
And that's where my brain resolves it, and I'm cool with it.
Doc is out of time in every time he's in, though.
Oh,
I see what you did there.
I like it. And that's what he put on his application to the California DMV for the license plate, out of time.
Did you guys talk about that in the first movie, that he actually got a custom license plate for his car?
Yeah, for his time machine.
Why wouldn't he?
With one extra letter than is allowed in the state of California.
He had to get that way before he actually tested the car out.
Yeah, he figured, if you're going to make a time machine, why not do it with style?
All right.
Yeah.
Maybe he's been driving a car with that license plate for decades. Since 1955.
Right, yeah.
Amazing.
This is just an amazing coincidence. He transferred that plate from his Volkswagen van.
So Clara comes, they save her. It is love at first sight. He's like, oh, Marty, it would have to be love at first sight. That's not going
to
happen.
And it kind of has to be if you look at the runtime of the movie and how far
absolutely.
And how many days they have. Yeah.
Right.
Well, they could have made this, Marty is with Doc for months, right? But they don't. Yeah. They're like, 6 days. That's it. Like, we got to get this over with.
And these guys are clowns when it comes to using a time machine. Like, always cutting
themselves. Right? Yeah, 10 minutes ought to be enough. Yeah, they're not great.
Yeah, they're very Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck with things, where it's like, all right, this time we're going to be serious. Serious? Serious. Okay. And then all kinds of hijinks ensue.
Yeah.
But while the hijinks are happening, the movie really makes sure you know what day it is, how long they have to go. They're constantly like, here's the calendar. Or later on in the bar, there's the clock outside the window. So, this thing is coming up, and now it's 7 o'clock. Now it's 8 o'clock. They really, chronology is important in this series.
But it's like it's moving toward high noon, a movie that is a Western that is being referenced to. It's all connected, people.
Yeah. Feeling the ticking clock. It's so effective without really beating you over the head with it. It's that you're constantly aware of it in the background.
High Noon, also shot in my hometown, by the way.
This whole movie is just all around Jason's hometown.
It's all about me. It is. This is the one. This is the one, Moises. Give it to me. Okay, so there's a festival for the new courthouse building with a clock, at which ZZ Top plays their big hit song, the one with the fiddle.
The one ZZ Top song with a fiddle.
Thumbs way down on the spinning the guitar and drum around, by the way. He did not
need that.
ZZ
Top, they have to do it. This fits right in with the terrible product placement in the other two movies. Yeah.
This one, this scene is the one that I find the most annoying. Because, like, I don't like ZZ Top being in there. I don't like that Marty is good at shooting because he's played video games. Like, I don't
because
think that's
how
it
works. Because they set it up in the second
movie.
Well
established, yeah.
Yeah, we all, my kids thought they were good at ice skating because they were good at the Wii ice skating, and then they went to a real ice skating rink and discovered that wasn't true. Marty does not discover that in this. He just turns out he's good at shooting things.
The moment I love in that scene, the only thing I really love in that whole thing, including all the stuff with... Strickland, whatever else. The only thing I like is when Marty sees the Frisbee Blackers tray and he says, far out. Far and they're out. So confused. And,
yeah. I'm confused too. Far out is not from 1985. That's from the 60s.
Yeah, but still, it's slang
that was right in front of him.
That they don't know in 1885, right?
I was in California in 1985. We were not saying far out, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe sarcastically, but it doesn't matter. They don't understand any of these words that he's saying, which is pretty funny.
The annoyances Lex has about this Marty thing, I think is more like over the course of these movies, here's the unpopular controversial thing. I kind of think Marty sucks. Marty, the Mary Sue syndrome, he is a Marty Stew. Like, he's just magically great at shooting. He's magically great at this. He's magically great at that.
He is.
And I feel like his arc by the end of this movie becomes this popular, wealthy guy whose bully was brought to heel and now serves him. And did he become the bully?
So Marty in the first movie, like when we talked about the first movie, I think he has a little bit of that Harrison Ford, Bruce Willis frantic vulnerability that he uses to great effect in other movies made around the same time starring Michael J. Fox. So he is a hero who can make mistakes and does feel stress and does feel anxious and can be hurt and can fail before he ultimately succeeds. And I think the main problem with him and Doc in this whole thing is that by the third movie in, like the first movie, it's just a fun ride and everything sort of comes together. But if you're going to continue with these characters, they kind of have to have arcs. They do that terrible thing of saying, well, we've just discovered that Marty has a terrible character flaw, that if he's called chicken, he'll do anything. And we're not going to resolve that in the second movie. You're just going to be annoyed by it. We'll resolve it in the third movie, and we'll resolve it by simply having him not do that anywhere.
And that's not much
of a character arc. And I feel like this is not a slam on the third movie, which I do think is better than the second, but by the third movie in, I feel like the charm is wearing off a bit for me, especially the charm of Marty. And his charm in the first movie is still entirely preserved, but three movies in, because these characters were never really designed to have a three movie story about them. Like, I appreciate the riffing, and I appreciate, you know, it's a fun type of Western, but the individual character, Marty's charm is kind of gone in the same way that by the end of Secret of My Success, you're like, okay, I'm over this guy, too. He lasts three movies in this one.
Unsurprisingly, I disagree with John on this, but I, like, what I appreciate about Marty the whole time is that he's never a jerk. Like, he's super polite to Clara. He knows that Doc shouldn't be with Clara, and he's polite to her. He goes back, even though Doc didn't want him to, because he's going to save Doc's life. When he, you know, beats up whatever the tenant is that he's after, he's never horrifying about it, right? He doesn't shoot him. He doesn't do anything that's going to cause permanent damage. He's relying on, you know, his wits and his fists and whatever else. Like, I think that Marty, I agree. I hate the chicken / yellow sudden character flaw. It's terrible. But I appreciate that Marty does grow as a person, and like he cares a lot. He's worried about Jennifer. He's worried about, like, he's shown to get better over time.
He's a jerk. I'm just saying his charm is worn off. There's some magic and charisma and charm that you really want to be rooting for him, and has to seem like an underdog. And by the third movie, I feel like I'm rooting for Doc in this movie more than I'm rooting for Marty. Not that I dislike him. He's not unlikable, but it's like, I'm not sure his charm in this character and these scripts can carry it for three movies. So
the biggest problem I think he has is that he seems to get old. Like, Marty McFly in the third one does not seem like high school Marty McFly.
Well, unsurprisingly, since I broached the Marty sucks conversation, I disagree with Lex. And I think for me, the problem is that Marty's arc becomes, well, he became less of a reactionary hothead, not a jerk, but less of a reactionary hothead. And I think it's good that as an example to people that looked up to Michael J. Fox as an actor, to Marty as a character, it's good that in the High Noon showdown with Mad Dog, he resorts to non-lethal methods, but at the same time, he's speaking with his fists. So it's kind of a, it's a very Reagan era thing.
Well, as Shelley told us in our last episode, mm-hmm, this whole series is very much like some problems can be solved by punching people.
That's the 80s for you.
That is, yeah, exactly. And it is a very 80s concept to
have. This is high-minded. I mean, it's not as high-minded as Return of the Jedi, obviously, but it's high-minded for an 80s, you know, popcorn movie that he puts the gun down.
By that time, though, he had already put the gun down. Like, he's mm-hmm. in the saloon, and he's like, he's an ass. Oh, sorry, I can't say that on here.
I mean, sure.
He's an a-hole.
You stopped short. You did a good job.
Yeah. And he was ready to just walk away and leave, but Biff got Doc. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, he had to go face him. Like, he was ready to just walk away, though.
Yeah, that's the kind of plot contrivance that kind of bugs me. Like, when the hero says, I'm not going to kill the villain. Oh no, now the villain is forcing me to kill him.
Yeah. Well, he just punched him.
Yeah. I think the most important thing Marty does in the movie is allow Doc to say Marty a lot, which he really should. He should call him Clint sometimes, but
he doesn't.
Christopher Lloyd says Marty so well.
Yeah, I mean, Marty doesn't have the problem with Marty in this movie. Like, I think part of the reason he doesn't get to be his charming self is not because the actor doesn't have charm. It's like in the first movie, he was constantly put in unexpected and uncomfortable situations that we had to see him get out of. And even in the second movie, he had a lot of those when we mentioned, like, he was sneaking around underneath Strickland's desk and sneaking around himself in the first movie. And in this movie, he's not really called upon to be put into uncomfortable and challenging situations that he doesn't know how he's going to get his way out of. He does one or two of them, but, like, that is the basis of the first movie. And, you know, Doc is a side character. And here, I feel like this is a Doc and Marty tag team story, and the main problem is Biff is annoying me and chasing after me, and I don't want him to kill Doc, and they dispatch with Biff earlier than I had remembered in this movie, and then just to do the rest of the, you know, fun chase thing or whatever. But it's not like my mother's in love with me, I can't let anybody see me, I have to fit it in the 50s, I have to do this, I have to drive the car like that. He's not asked to be Michael J. Fox in an 80s movie, constantly be putting out uncomfortable situations. So he doesn't have as much opportunity to be his charming self.
Also, once they deal with Buford, there's no ticking clock. They do not need to destroy a train anymore.
Yeah, well, they have the point of no return to at least make you think, well, now they have to either do it or die. So,
well, that point, yeah. But right after Buford gets arrested, they could stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right.
They don't have a lot of trust in the legal system.
I also don't know that they're present for the arrest.
Mm, yeah, that's fair. They ran away or whatever. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, but the movie just wants us to move on at that point.
I mean, you're gonna have a train chase.
I know. Like, you're on the roller coaster at that point.
Yeah, the train's got to leave the station. Up, the train's left the station. Guess what? That's where we're going.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
The one comment I think this is a challenge that this movie has because it's viewed over, you know, 5 years, essentially, 3 movies. But the truth is, in Marty's timeline, it's like days. Like, literally, this all happens.
He must be exhausted.
In a few days. Well, he does sleep occasionally. Yeah. But
Doc's got to be exhausted.
He's just funny head injuries.
Yeah, relatively speaking, for Marty, the whole stretch of all three of these movies takes the course of, like, 2 weeks of his life.
He's aged 10 years.
But not, yeah. Exactly. It was really only 5. I mean, it is that problem of people playing young and then they get a little older and they look a lot older than that, but it's fine. You know,
It's fine. They normally don't have to go and be in the same scene as they were in when they were 10 years younger.
Well, 5, but yeah, exactly. You're right. It does put that.
I mean, the thing is, the first movie caught Michael J. Fox like on his last month of boy face. Right, and then he got adult face for movies 2 and 3, and happens to us all, right? And that was it. That was the last of his boy face.
Yeah, it's true. So Doc does that we do the classic misunderstanding thing where he says, I have to go. And she says, well, why? And he says, well, I'm from the future. And she says, you're obviously just lying to me. So get out. And it's very sad. But of course,
that rarely works, by the way. And how many movies where someone has to explain to his love interest that he's from the future?
From the future.
Usually doesn't work out on the first try.
It's also fascinating to me, though, that his initial plan until Marty convinces him is to stay. Like that is, it's very surprising to me that Doc thinks that that's the move.
Yeah.
No, he seemed like he was happy there. He's not going to get shot and killed. Yeah.
He's in the same place as when he wrote the letter, right?
It's crazy, though, because he knows he doesn't belong there. It's not his time. He's very,
he plays pretty loosey-goosey with that rule.
Exactly. Doc is, when it's convenient to be worried about the space-time continuum and messing things up, then he's, then he's concerned.
But he's over that. By the first movie, he's over that. When he taped together the note, he's like, I figured, you know.
What the hell?
That's it for his prime directive.
But he's like, but no, you can't stay because we're going to change history and you can't know about your future, but I'm just going to stay.
He brought penicillin with him.
Personally,
it'll be fine.
Yeah. I'm going
to
stay.
He's established to his own satisfaction that causality doesn't exist and you can do whatever you want anytime you want.
I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, with his chalkboard diagram, he's like, I'm just creating splinter universes, so I don't really care.
I don't, maybe. And some of them get erased and who cares? Anyway, he in another cartoony but funny bit, he gets he goes on a bender, which is that he goes and orders a whiskey and the bartender, a lot of work for the bartender in this movie. He's like, are you sure, Doc? Yeah, I know what happened before. And he's like, I am sure. And then we see it and it's the next morning. And it's like, how many drinks has he had? And he's like, it's the same one.
He just likes to hold it. Just likes to hold it.
And then he drinks it and immediately passes out. And they have to put...
Because he's regaling the bar with tales of the future. And you think he's drunk. That's a pretty good gag. That and the ice machine making gag is a long way to go for some pretty good punchlines.
I'm not sure how he could play Doc drunk is the problem. Because he's already kind of wobbly.
That's why he passes out. He's just so close to the edge. That one drink brings him over the edge.
As a kid and as an adult, I love the whole wake up juice moment. I love that he wakes up and then immediately passes out in the trough. I love all of it. And then I love that he's like, oh, he's going to need another 10 minutes to wake up. And Marty's like, 10 minutes? Why do we have to cut these things so damn close? Like, They have no trouble hanging hats on it. I love it.
I love how they go full duck-a-muck like that, where they hang all the hats on everything and you admire the hat hanging and it doesn't interfere with everything. It's look, we are going to ring every single one of these bells and you're going to like it. And we did.
Oh, and speaking of that, and the Biff punch out thing, which obviously we've seen the original and we see it revisited in the second movie. In the third movie, Biff will be punched out, but Biff is a lot bigger than you, or Buford Tannen is a little bit bigger than you might think he is. So there's that little hitch and pause in the music when he's got to punch him a second time.
Yeah.
And I know fists aren't the answer, but they did a good job. Third movie riff on the punch out. Third movie, and the little pause is like, and he's actually kind of big. Okay, now he's down.
I mean, another note from the Tom Wilson Appreciation Society, that kind of timing, like getting hit, it's one thing to sell hitting, but getting hit with something that you don't have like on set, what the music cues are going to be, you're giving them something that they're going to apply a cue to later, is beautiful. Underappreciated bit of this is after he thinks that he shot and killed Marty, like Mad Dog's little victory dance that he does is
when he walks up, he's in the Biff, the Biff celebration poser, and crouches down and puts his arm. Comes out.
It's funny when Marty fell and that metal thing fell off onto the ground. It seemed extraneous at the time, it's actually
That's the thing. Like this is it's a cartoon movie, right? But if you get hit in the face with the cast iron door from a stove, you are dead.
Also one of my favorite random exchanges happens right before he comes out. Marty asks the bartender, you got a back door in this place? And the bartender says, it's in the back.
I knew you'd like that one. Lex Friedman humor 100%.
It's the greatest.
That is really good. That's the
is there a way out of here? Yeah, through that door, basically.
The Doc telling everybody about the future and them not and laughing at him and not believing him reminded me of I think a few years before this, there was Henry Weinhard's beer ad that was set in the Old West where there's a stranger at the bar and he says, in 100 years, a man will walk on the moon. And only girls will ride horses, and they all and Henry Weinhardt's beer will be served as far away as New York City is the punchline there. And I kept thinking of that because it's the same thing, which is like, I'm telling you things that are true. And the people are like, you are a crazy man. Go away. Uh-huh. Like, they just do not believe him at all. I love that stuff. Oh, by the way, the manure, many of the signs, as you come into town, as Marty comes uh-huh. into town, there are many signs with names on them that are the same names that are, because Hill Valley is all about family names remaining in exactly their same jobs right. over a century.
They only have Easter male children who keep their names. That's
yes,
it.
Including the manure. And you see the manure and you're like, it's manure. We it's know always what's going to happen
business.
There.
This is the manure trilogy. This town has yep. always been about manure. It's at a manure. Heart, it's about hauling manure. Where does manure come from? Where does it go? Yeah.
He has to spit it out of his mouth, which is really cruel.
Forget yeah. it, Jason. It's manure town.
It is. I mean, at least this movie, you see where it comes from. But I don't understand, like, the manure that's traveling through Hill Valley of the 50s and 80s. And what is its journey?
Well, remember how we complained about how green the city was in the modern times? Fertilizer.
Yeah. All their topsoil is just manure. It used to be a desert, but now it's a
You're lucky this movie. Yeah. These movies aren't in smell-o-vision, okay?
Another reason, Marty McFly's journey sucks is that it endorses the notion of inherited wealth and that only the privileged should continue to rule.
It's an immigrant story. They came here with nothing. Inherited.
I mean, you know, over a century ago.
All right, so the climactic, and it is really well put together. The Clara's on the train.
Before Clara gets on the train, let's just talk about Clara's journey here. She becomes an action hero about an hour and 15 minutes into this movie. She's on a horse. She's jumping off the horse onto the train. She's climbing through the train, and at the last minute, she becomes a damsel. But anyway, up to that point, she does some amazing work.
Yeah, absolutely.
This train is not going 70 miles an hour.
The horses can't run 88, but they can run 70.
First, she pulls the emergency thing and gets off of it and goes back to town. But they have gone to the time machine and are going to flip the switch and all of that. And she is on the train, but there ends up being a whole thing where she's hanging. Marty's in the DeLorean. The hoverboard goes to Doc. Doc uses that because it's that hoverboard to save Clara.
It makes no sense that he catches that hoverboard.
No, it's one shot at it, and he gets it right on his foot. So I guess they practice that? No, it doesn't make any sense. What we don't know is when Doc was in the future in the beginning, he became the world's foremost hoverboard trick artist. And that just, we just didn't get into that, Brian, in the second movie. We didn't get into that part of it. About
Tony
how good
Hawk
he is
from 2015 spent a lot of time teaching Doc how to do this.
Yeah, the rejuvenation treatment has made him spryer, is what I'm saying.
All the messing with the space-time continuum, hoverboards ended up being designed around Doc's specific physiognomy.
Yeah, it's a magnetically coated.
I don't understand how the hoverboard never runs out of power. Like, it does take power. We know that from the second one, but it never runs out.
Lex, it's from the future.
It's solar. Mr. Fusion, which can do this, but not this other thing that seems pretty simple. Yeah.
Well, the time machine requires a huge amount of power. Hoverboard requires very little. They take a stick of gum and jam it into a slot, and that's.
But we know
energy.
It can't go over water unless you have power. So I'm just saying.
Exactly.
That's the whole thing. We didn't mention that in the first movie, but the hoverboards, they do work over water. If they didn't, he would sink into the water, but he doesn't. Right. He floats.
It's powered by plot juice, a notoriously unreliable source of power.
So, but they do save the day. But what happens is they don't come back to the DeLorean. So it's all that sort of Doc saying, maybe I'll just stay in the past. Marty hits 88 miles an hour, goes over the ravine on the bridge. It is now Eastwood Ravine because she didn't die because they saved her. And so she didn't fall into the ravine. And now the story apparently is going to be that Clint Eastwood died in the ravine.
I don't know why they would name it after the guy who, I guess, brought down Buford Tannen, but then stole a train.
You got to name it after something. They named it after her when she died in it. He died in it too. So
I think
there you go.
Doc and Clara agitated for it to be named after him. I think.
Yeah,
that's
but she died.
They know it was him. Wasn't he masked? Wasn't that the point of the masks?
Doc could have told everybody that.
Yeah. That was my friend Clint Eastwood, whose name I've never once used.
said. It's Marty. I mean Eastwood. So Marty's back in
arbitrary rules on law enforcement. Given that Buford said, we're going to go rob that stage right in front of the sheriff. And the sheriff was like, I didn't hear that.
Well, you can't be convicted of a crime you haven't done yet.
I know nobody wants to hear it, but that stagecoach also from Columbia State Historic Park. I've ridden in that stagecoach. Okay. They're back in 1985, a place that I'm not from. Well, actually, I am sort of, aren't I? But no, this is, they're back in first movie land. Marty The DeLorean is on the train tracks.
Marty has no care about being on that train track. Get off the train track. Even before it becomes a plot point that he has to get off there, get off the train track. What are you doing?
He wasn't that disoriented the last time he went back in time. And he's just suddenly, it's like his vision is returning to him. Like he time traveled in a Star Trek movie.
He's used to being on a train track now. And he's like, well, this is what I do now. And then a train is coming his direction. And he's like, no. And the train, which doesn't stop, it just keeps going. Just smashes the DeLorean into a million pieces. Oh no, DeLorean!
I love how much train-based destruction happens in this movie. We destroy a train.
They hit something with a train in this movie. It didn't even look like a miniature to me. I think they actually hit something with a train.
Yeah,
they hit the blockade saying "end of track," and that was fine.
That train really blew up pretty good when it hit the bottom of the ravine, too.
Yeah.
They really plussed up that explosion.
Oh. The final golden age of destroying trains and movies.
Explosive steam. So the DeLorean is destroyed. Oh no. But Marty goes back to his house and Jennifer is there, of course, in his truck. Remember again, this is the future that Marty didn't live through, but he lives there now. We get that finally the culmination of two screenplays worth of story development where Needles, again, music's Flea. Needles, who in part two convinces Marty to do the thing that is against the rules that gets him fired by Fax, by his boss.
Well, can we just talk about Needles' journey here? He was a punk in this movie. And a few short years later, he's in middle management. He's really made something of himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Except also, he's
Needles'
a creep.
Gang is consists of various people who have been in Biff's gangs or Tannen's gangs in the past.
Yes.
Well, that makes sense. So Needles is the new Biff. Because Biff has, again, Tom Wilson, another riff on Biff, is now the cowardly, cringing Biff.
Mm-hmm. Riff on Biff. I like that. It's a Biff riff.
My favorite Dr. Seuss book.
Niels is playing some Huey Lewis out of his car.
He's a punk rocking out to Huey Lewis.
I love yes, movie he is. Punks. Like that so anyway, he says, in the Star Trek movie.
He says that Marty Chicken? And it's the moment where it's like, oh, remember, hey, everybody, remember that big moment in the second movie where we said that Marty got in a car accident?
But he already did that in the Old West. Like, they go back to that, well, he already got over the chicken thing in the Old West. And
I
now
know.
And then they do it again.
I don't like it. I don't like this.
It's like, the audience should be saying to themselves, wait a second, he's not susceptible to that anymore.
Does he really show growth if he keeps having to relearn that lesson?
Yeah. Well, then what he chooses to do is not to... Yeah, not to not participate in the drag race, but to do something probably equally as dangerous, which is to go backwards really fast. I mean, I guess he could see that there was no one behind him, but in general,
end up in the
frowned
wrong
upon.
Lane.
Yeah, care his girlfriend for no reason.
That's right.
Yeah. At least tell her, don't worry, I'm not going to race.
His girlfriend, who, due to his shenanigans at the space-time continuum from movie one into movie two, became a whole new person.
Yes,
who he has
true.
No issue whatsoever. His eye is on the prize. I'm going to have that nuclear family in the future.
This is like while you were sleeping, because she sleeps through like two-thirds of a trilogy. Like she's just on that porch, and
she's
then we pick her up.
So, but they have that moment where it's like, oh, but that car came right out of there. That would have gotten me.
The Rolls Royce, yeah.
Yeah, the Rolls Royce from the second movie.
Because what happens is if you get into an accident with rich people, they take more money from you than if you get into accidents with
your hand gets
rich.
More broken.
I guess. I never liked this entire thing. I think they wanted, basically the idea here is they wanted in the second movie to have Marty's future be disappointing so that he would have to learn and grow with the thing that they added about him being called Chicken, which again, I mean, if we talk about this being a cartoon, that is a cartoonish character flaw, right? Rather than having a real episode of learning and growing, it's really
right.
just
but it's one that's not established till the second movie, so which hurts it even
yeah,
more.
Yeah, I know. Don't lose your mind when somebody calls you Chicken is like a real life lesson, but okay.
And
anyway,
don't run into
it.
A Rolls Royce, you know,
it's
keep
surprising
playing guitar.
To me that he's equally affected by being called Yellow. Like, I don't know how many high school kids would have been affected by Yellow if they were in Indiana.
He saw the French's Mustard commercial.
I think that's really funny because we've been told in the second movie that it's Chicken, don't call me Chicken. And so, but they wouldn't say Chicken in the Old West. So he says, you're Yeller. And yeah. And I'm thinking, is he even going to react to that? Because what does he know? And instead, Marty does exactly the same thing. He says, nobody calls me yellow. And he pronounces it yellow.
I think people know, even in the 80s, knew that that was a synonym for
cowardice. But it's a funny bit that the movie is doing where it's like, even with the synonyms, it's not like a word trigger, right? It's a conceptual trigger with Marty. That's what's going
on.
I think that's a funny bit. In a thing of a thing I do not like, I think the fact that the name changes is actually funny because I hate it.
Well, luckily the movie does not end with this beat. It ends with the awesome time travel train.
So we go back to the train tracks. Again, a train has struck a car on the tracks. There are no authorities around, just pieces of rubble all over the tracks for the next train to run over and perhaps derail.
I want to know, self-cleaning.
Who exactly designed the railroad crossing things? Because they are extremely impressive in this movie. They go off when Marty's driving, and they go off when the train from the past is going to come before it's there.
You're not thinking fourth dimensionally, Lex.
Yeah, I always have a problem with that.
Well, Lex, Doc designed them.
Lex, it's a thing from the future. You wouldn't get it. You wouldn't understand it.
It's there to prevent time traveling trains from smashing into cars. Mm-hmm. Doc is
doesn't
on top of it.
Oh, it doesn't anyway, stop regular train from crashing into time traveling things. I got it.
No, yeah, he's not doing that. You know, no, then Doc comes through so that his train can be there safely.
Yeah, it's his pre-temporal incursion warning system that he built in.
So look, the DeLorean is all pieces. It's very sad. But suddenly, in a fun, I think, very fun twist, a train appears on the tracks via time machine, and it's Doc and Clara and their two sons, Jules and Vern.
Yeah, little ornery, those two.
Yeah.
Oh, Vern's ornery because he got named Vern.
Yeah. Hey, Vern.
Know what I mean?
Doc says, "Oh, I've got the complete picture of us by the clock tower. Isn't that really nice?" And Jennifer, by the way, in the fired by fax thing, the fax faded away. So she's like, "But what does this mean that the fax faded away?" And Doc says, "Ah, it means what it always means, which is despite many things that I've said in this movie about how time travel works, your future is unwritten and you can choose where you want to go from here."
Just like the end of the Terminator movies.
But what are you going to do? How are you going to get out of here, Doc? And he's like, "Oh, we've already been to the future." And they literally replay the bit from the first movie where the train lifts off the tracks and flies forward and off into an unknown time with his family. And that is the end. As
when do you
says,
think he goes?
The end of Back to the Future, Part 3.
Where does he go? They made an animated series.
The planet,
that continued the whole thing.
Not canonical. Planet of the Apes is where they went next. Lex, Planet of the Apes.
Continuing their poor choices about where and when to travel. And how.
I think he went to December 25th, 0000.
Exactly. Oh, right. Looking for the birth of Christ and not knowing anything about history and being very confused.
Yeah. Man in a train appears in the Holy Land. Actually, he doesn't, because they don't travel in space. So it's Man in the Train appears in Hill Valley, California in the year zero and goes, "Clara, there's nobody here."
My one complaint about that train is they had that like fast rotating thing next to the cartoon U-shaped horseshoe-shaped magnet, red and silver horseshoe-shaped magnet. And they have a whole dialogue scene between Doc and Clara up on the train and Marty and Jennifer on the ground. And they're standing so close to that rapidly spinning thing that has no protection on it whatsoever. It's like OSHA has not inspected this train. It just seems incredibly dangerous.
It's Doc Brown. It's fine.
Yeah, I don't think Doc does a lot of safety measures.
I think it's future-proofed.
Why are the kids so cranky? Like, do they just not want to do another take where the kids looked happier?
Dad,
they just look so upset and disinterested.
Stop introducing me to people.
Yeah. And then, they see how they're dressed. I think it works in the story because they have to wear those outfits and they're not happy about it.
Right. And they get no lines. So, they just have to stand there and be still the whole time. There's nothing fun there.
I feel bad for kid actors who have to do things like this where they don't, they're not hiring them because they are comfortable saying lines and they're extroverted as performers, but they're like, you look like we want in this, this little bow tied, 1880s kid. And, you have a look
outfit.
Too. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, where were they when they were having these kids? And I guess they're twins because they look like they're the same age.
Mean, when were they?
When?
Yes, indeed. Hopefully they didn't go to the long time ago in a galaxy far, far away because she would have died in childbirth.
Yeah, no, they went to the future. Clearly, they went to the future.
Yeah, in the year 3000, certain styles came back.
Yeah, that's what happened. It's totally, totally true. This time,
the thing they did with the train taking off and going or whatever, I don't know. I'm sure there's some history that can explain this, but like, that's an ending that would make you think that they're going to do another one of these movies. And right. If this movie was remotely successful and today, they would just keep making these movies forever and ever and ever. And yet they did not make another one, despite the fact that they had reestablished. We still have a time machine. These characters still exist and they're going off to another unknown place. And don't you wonder where they went off to and what adventures they had? Well, we're not going to cash in on that. So
they did forever. In the animated series. That's why they made the animated series, because doing it as features, the studio wanted more, but I think the creatives were like, look, if you want to do an animated show that's basically the Magic School Bus, but you got the magic time traveling train and none of it really officially counts, fine, knock yourselves out. We don't want to try to crank out three more movies that we don't really like. There isn't enough gas in the tank.
And they didn't get anyone else to do it. Like, I mean, I don't remember how this movie didn't do as well in the box office, but like,
no, it did fine.
It is the ending that's leading you straight up to what will their next adventure be? And
It did fine. It came in the era when you could do a Saturday morning cartoon that itself would rake in a big pile of money that had less risk attached to it than going, okay, we're going to mount a whole new trilogy of movies.
And the Bobs also felt they were done. They didn't want to make any more. They wanted it to be done.
That is so rare that they would A, not want to make another one, and B, that the people who own the IP wouldn't say, well, I don't care what you want. We're going to eventually make more of them. And they didn't.
Time was that you could get things into contracts to not give yourself necessarily ownership, but give you veto power
exactly.
Over
can you imagine
further exploitation and stuff.
Even when people do that these days, they like wait for them to die or then get their estate to do it later.
You're right. Today it's hard to imagine that it wouldn't inevitably happen, but because Bob Zemeckis controls the rights, he's like, we're not going to do it. And with Michael J. Fox having all of his medical complications with his Parkinson's, it's like, it's not going to ever happen, and that's okay. You're right. It's great that they did an animated series, but they could have gone on, but they didn't. And it's okay. Yeah. Like, it's okay. I never really yearned for it, but honestly, this time watching part three, I thought I could see how you could make many more movies where they have adventures in time and space, but they didn't. Instead, they made a cartoon.
A very inconsistent quality, because surely they would start going even more downhill, and some would be good, sure. Some of them wouldn't be. It's very much like Doctor Who in that way.
Or they might all be like this one.
Yeah.
Eventually, shouldn't they run into Bill and Ted?
I think they did a crossover comic series that was like Back to the Future meets Bill and Ted or something.
There's a t-shirt that that Lauren has that's called It Came Out of Nowhere, and it's the DeLorean crashing into the TARDIS. It's great. So that's my crossover.
I like that this went closed-ended in terms of the official canon of things, even though, the animated series existed. And I like looking at these three movies where there are spaces within it to what if on my own, where, you know, Doc and Clara flew off on that hoverboard. Where did the idea to make a train happen? Well, maybe he just said, well, honey, we blew up a train. Why don't we build a train? And, you know, I can think about that kind of stuff in my idle hours because apparently I have nothing better to do.
Nope.
But I didn't need them to just squeeze every last bit of juice out of this concept. And
they would have made a prequel movie where they had to catch lightning to give the energy for the train time to travel. That would have been bad.
So one of the things I appreciate about this series, since we are at the end of it now, is all three of these movies are distinct. Not all film series feel that way, right? Not all film series. Sometimes the movies get really samey. but like these three movies are all trying to do different things. And that's the thing actually that I appreciate, as I think I said before, about the third movie here, is that it is not trying to rewrite, partially because it was conceived of along with the second movie and shot with the second movie. They made a decision to make a different kind of movie, and it tells different parts of, you know, it's got, they've got connective elements and all that, but like The third movie is the one in the Old West. It is a really different movie. The second movie is the one that goes into the future and also rewrites the first movie. And then there's the first movie. They all feel very different, and I appreciate that about this series.
Have they ever done two movies shot at the same time that were more different than these? Literally, one is a Western, right? And the other one has nothing. Yeah. Like, usually you do two movies at the same time because you're going to reuse a lot of the same sets.
Only Modern Hill Valley was shot in the same, even like production
on the back block.
Mm-hmm. And the rest of it was obviously they've shot the second movie and then technically, I guess we should say they shot them back to back because I think that's basically what they did. Yeah.
Yeah. It was one overall like production train.
Both scripts were ready.
You know, they did the Hill Valley backlot stuff for two. And then while that was getting shifted over to three, they did all the on location stuff for two. And then they went into the location stuff for three. And then they doubled back to the lot. I mean, this is presumptive, just kind of having seen the way that they cycled between locations in the supplemental materials and things. They planned it so that they could redress things as, you know, bare bones Old West whatever, and just pull a bunch of stuff out and cover it in dirt.
It feels like more of like a financial innovation and a movie making innovation, mm-hmm. more than a story one, because again, these two and three are not interlocked like one and two are. You know what I mean? If you told me that you're going to shoot two movies back to back or simultaneously, one and two would make so much more sense. But obviously, they didn't do that. They shot two and three, which do not crisscross and intersect back with each other constantly.
So, any final thoughts before we go about Back to the Future 3, or indeed the Back to the Future film series? Now is your chance.
Even the worst Back to the Future movie, which was this one, is still a great movie.
I have to think about this one after, you know, seeing one, two, and three, and, you know, one is so far above two and three in my estimation that it's in a separate category. But then I had to think, okay, well, what about two and three? Which one of those do you like better? And in the end, when I had to go back to my Letterboxd rating and like re-rate them, I ended up giving them exactly the same rating because two had many more things that were bad in it. But I think the cleverness of revisiting scenes from the movie I love the most in two, like it has more highs and more lows, whereas this one I feel like is, you know, the highs are not as high, but there aren't really a lot of lows either. And so they both come out basically the same at that point. They're very different movies. And if I didn't want to be annoyed, I would watch three. But there's so much stuff that I love in two amidst the stuff that I hated in two. So it's kind of strange. But hey, if you're going to have a trilogy where, you know, again, in my opinion, the first movie is just like, you know, beautifully done, like an amazing example of its form. I think I use the example of a Karate Kid. It's like, if you don't like that kind of movie, fine. But if you do, Karate Kid is the pinnacle of that form. Back to the Future is kind of the pinnacle of that kind of 80s movie. Does not set a foot wrong, really, except for obviously the dated 80s stuff that we know better about now. And then two, extremely ambitious, falls on its face a little bit. Three, they said, let's do a Western. I give them a total pass. So this, you know, if that's your trilogy, it's pretty good by trilogy averages. There's so many bad trilogies out there. And, you know, there's one or two really phenomenal ones. But the Back to the Future trilogy, especially the fact that they stopped after three, even though I think it's really one great movie and two silly sequels, I think it's, I look back on the whole trilogy fondly. They made three pretty okay movies.
Yeah, to John's point, I don't think, like, none of the three of these are bad movies. None of them are a disaster. And the thing about how they vary from one to the other makes it so that people have a different favorite one for different reasons. You know, I can love this one because of the strategic deployment of people like Richard Dysart as the barbed wire salesman, who I swear when I watched it this time, I was like, did they cast Douglas Trumbull as a barb? No, that's Richard Dysart. But, you know, Western actors like Pat Buttram and Harry Carey Jr. and Dub Taylor, Burton Gilliam from Blazing Saddles, a movie Jason hates. I love those kinds of little callbacks to this particular genre. And I love how there are things that I love about two different than this. And there are things I love about the first one, which recasting your lead while already days into production, you know, makes it as much as I think the original film in a trilogy kind of has an advantage in that it is setting the groundwork for everything. It is a little bit rougher because they were rushed and it was a little bit more chaotic. And one of the things that I like so much about this movie specifically is that they knew that they were smoothly backing in to the end of things, and the polish and the care, again, I'll mention Dean Cundey's cinematography.
we get that shot of Clara writing at her desk in her home. That's a frame inside of a window frame, and the amount of care in shot composition in this movie in particular, and there are beautiful shot compositions in the other two movies too. But this movie in particular, one of the things that I think makes it so beautiful is the way that everything's framed. Cause it's not, the framing is not just a reference to stuff like a bunch of the metatextual stuff in the script and the casting and the using of the ZZs and the tops and so on. They found little corners in which to do neat things and that weren't required of, you know, making something look futuristic, and they weren't trying to make this look exactly like The Searchers or a specific Western or something. It was very much a movie made in the late 1980s that was framing things and making things look beautiful on photochemical film back when that was what they were using, and the natural lighting that they could get and the artificial lighting that they were using, you know, the interiors being lit by candlelight and fires in different places. It looks different than interior shot in other parts of the series. And that kind of variance is something that I love across all three movies. There's something different in all three of them. And sometimes I want to, you know, watch my way all through all three of them, like I would when I first saw these on VHS at a friend's Ooh. House, you know, a weekend afternoon interrupted by meals and going out and playing and that kind of thing. And sometimes, you know, I just want to throw on two. Sometimes I just want to throw on three. Sometimes the first one.
I like intricate time travel nonsense movies, so I've seen Back to the Future 2 a few times. The last time I saw Back to the Future 3 was the weekend of May 25th, 1990 at the Fashion Valley Cinema in San Diego, California. So this time I did not watch Back to the Future 1 or 2. I just went straight into 3. I really liked it.
Yeah.
I did not necessarily get every Easter egg reference to the other movies, which I think helped. Like,
good.
Oh, what weird name is he going to use this time? I even without all that, in fact, especially without all that, this movie stands up on its own. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I think it's even if, yes, ranking aside, that's what I came away with, having not seen it very often in the intervening years, is I just had fun. Like, it's a fun movie. And yeah, it could be seen as silly, it could be seen as lesser to compare to the other movies if you want to do all that, but like I agree with what John said about trilogy wise right, like it's a good trilogy, and it doesn't have the movie where it's like, oh, that's a really bad one that went completely off the rails, and this one is lighter, I would say, and slighter, and that's okay. It's fun. They left me wanting more, which is not a bad thing at all. And there is definitely, I think, honestly, the conventional wisdom is that people really like the third movie of Back to the Future. I think that it's like everybody remembers the original and they love it. I think feelings are mixed or complicated about the second one. But then the third one, everybody's like, oh yeah, the Old West. Like, what's not to like about it? Which might not mean that it's as weighty or
Lex
clever.
Lex has a list for you.
But like, it's fun. Like, it's just fun.
They wisely measured that, like, they couldn't do what so many things do now, which is, you know what we did in the second movie? Third one's going to do that even harder. We're going to double and triple back on ourselves. We're going to go like the Netflix series Dark. Like, they had pushed it to the limit, because, like, the first movie, like I said, when we talked about that one, worked so hard to bring everybody along and to make sure everybody got all the possible enjoyment they could out of it. Second movie is more challenging. Third movie, if they had done that again, and like, now we're going through the first and the second movie and doing that, there was a third Marty there you didn't even know.
Yeah.
No, they said, you know what? Old West. And everybody, it's like a relief. You're like, oh, I'm comfortable with that. I like these characters. I want to see them have an adventure. And this movie is not asking me to do anything except for have our fond memories of the first two movies. And even that's not mandatory.
And in terms of like historical success, the first movie made just shy of $400 million. The second one made a little over $300 million. This one made about $250 million. So just over 200,000. But because this was the age of VHS becoming cheaper and more affordable, these three movies' overall success, like that they made the second and the third ones back to back, they knew that they were packaging these as a trilogy and that is how they would be packaged for cable sales and everything. And in the modern, you know, oh, did this installment of the Marvel movies, you know, did Ant-Man 3 do as well as Ant-Man 2 or whatever? really didn't figure as much in the way that they packaged this in terms of a financial success. And they knew that they were finishing a thing. And then the conversation would be, what do we do with this as a, as an NBC Universal property? Well, then it was just Universal, as a Universal intellectual property, and how do we exploit it? And, you know, they made a cartoon, they made a ride for the theme park, and they made gigantic piles of merch that many of us have been collecting well into and past our middle age.
And don't forget Back to the Future, the game, the Telltale game.
Yeah.
It's also there. The brain trust. What's funny about this too is, even though it's a thing owned by Universal, as you said, you get the sense that it's really like that Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale kind of feel like they're the controllers of it, and Zemeckis has some control over that, but also that they're just, it's very near and dear to them, and they want to say yes or no. So like Bob Gale was involved in the Telltale game. Like that's just part of the deal, that they care about this stuff and they don't. And because they have that level of that Zemeckis can just say no, you know, they're not going to make more of these movies because Robert Zemeckis is just going to say no.
Once he dies though, you know.
Yeah. Well, eventually something will happen, but you know, maybe it'll be very, very,
it'll be a 10 episode Netflix thing. Cancel that for one season.
Wonderful. Hopefully we'll all be dead then too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we
Speak
won't
for
care.
Yourself.
We'll be in the future. All right. This has been great. It's fun talking about these movies. I'm glad Lex got to be here for two of them. Remember, we did that one episode about all of them that lasted 40 minutes that was live on a stage somewhere or something. And like, we can't do that again. So we did this instead. And it's been great. A little journey. It's not the summer of Back to the Future. It's just like a little midwinter time travel thing that we did. Let me thank my panelists for being here. Lex Friedman, of course, again. I'm sorry you weren't on part two, but I'm glad you got to be here on 2/3 of them.
You're the doc.
Ryan Warren, thank you too.
Jason, you're one in a Googleplex.
Monty Ashley, thank you.
Christopher Lloyd should have been able to star in many more movies.
I agree. He's great. Moises Chuyon, thank you.
I'm looking forward to us following the Christopher Lloyd connected universe with the Addams Family movies.
Maybe if I'm on vacation. And John Syracuse, thank you.
I'll be back for the Netflix series, probably.
All right. Okay. And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this 3-episode series that ended sort of where it started, just like Back to the Future. We will see you next time.